Peter B. Collins, news and comment for Monday, June 15, 2015. Time to pay your estimated taxes if you're self-employed.
But lies and deception, they move in one direction, and then in the end, you lose.
From London, Murdoch's respectable newspaper is launching smears based on anonymous leaks against Ed Snowden. And there could be a transatlantic conspiracy here, friends, because in Washington, the Obama administration is reeling from what appears to be the biggest hack on government computer systems ever. And it is a breach of personnel records that could put spies, spooks, and others, it appears to be everybody except the military, at some level of risk. And so it appears the game plan is to divert attention by blaming Ed Snowden. And so the media kind of reliably picked up the story from the Sunday Times. That's the Murdoch paper that doesn't have topless girls on page 3. And you may have heard last week that Rupert Murdoch, the 84-year-old founder of the empire, has stepped aside. He's not really stepping out of the picture. But he put his son James, who came to public prominence as a witness in the phone hacking scandal of the Murdoch tabloids just a couple of years ago, James is now in charge of running News Corp. But this story was probably already in the pipeline before the change of the guard at the top. So based on anonymous sources that are said to be part of the British government, the Sunday Times says that British intelligence believes that both the Russians and the Chinese have been able to access large portions of Ed Snowden's cache of leaked documents. But there's no proof offered. It's really a series of speculations and assertions with zero evidence offered. And one of the most eyebrow-raising comments is that this may have compromised British spies who have to be pulled out of the field. This quote from the Sunday paper, actually from the reporter who co-wrote the story. Well, we're told authoritatively by people in Downing Street, in the Home Office, in the intelligence services, that the Russians and Chinese have all this information. And as a result of that, our spies are having to pull people out of the field because their lives are in danger. Now pause for a moment and reflect. Ed Snowden didn't steal any documents that are British. He stole documents from the NSA and the Pentagon, from what we know. And while certainly those documents might have some information about British covert agents around the world, this idea that Snowden's compromises have forced the British to pull spooks out of their jobs just doesn't measure up to a basic bullshit test. So to his credit, Glenn Greenwald has penned a lengthy piece. He must have stayed up all night after he read the initial article in the Sunday Times of London. But he says this is journalism at its worst, and it's filled with falsehoods. And he's right. It is yellow journalism of the lowest order, and it amounts to a fascist expression because the collusion between the corporate media and government agencies in Britain, well, that fits the definition of fascism. And when they're pumping hysterical and false or unproven information into the public media at the behest of governments, yeah, that's fascism, in my humble opinion. So the article claims that Western intelligence agencies say that they have been forced into rescue operations after Moscow gained access to more than a million classified files held by the former American security contractor who fled to seek protection from Vladimir Putin. Now, right there, he did not try to seek protection from Russia or Putin. He was trapped there when the U.S. canceled his passport and made him unable to travel to Cuba or Ecuador or Venezuela, some of the destinations that have been mentioned. The Times story also says that senior government sources confirm that China has cracked the encrypted documents. Now, how do we know that? What's the basis? Well, no proof is offered. We're just told that sources confirm. And so the richness of these official leaks being aimed at an identified leaker like Ed Snowden is just so rich. Because, of course, they can leak with impunity. But when somebody like Snowden leaks in order to expose wrongdoing, to alert the public to massive spying on innocent people on a daily basis, well, that's a crime in their view. That's a traitor in operation. So one of the things that Greenwald readily attacks here is the tone. He says the whole article does literally nothing other than quote anonymous British officials. It gives voice to banal but inflammatory accusations that are made about every whistleblower from Dan Ellsberg to Chelsea Manning. It offers zero evidence or confirmation for any of its claims. And he is right. He says it's like being smeared by a ghost with a substance that you can't touch. And so, for example, one of the factual errors that Greenwald takes on that he has deep personal knowledge of is that his husband, David Miranda, traveled from Berlin via Heathrow to Brazil, where they live, with documents on hard drives that he got in Berlin from Laura Poitras, the filmmaker. But the Times of London said that Miranda was returning from Moscow with that information to create the illusion that Snowden had that information in Moscow, which everyone completely denies, including Snowden. He says, no, I gave it all away. I don't have anything. And the other thing that Greenwald attacks is the repeated use of the phrase blood on his hands. And so the British newspaper used that phrase about Snowden, even though there's no inclination or intimation of any sort that anybody has died or even bled, you know, as a result of the disclosures made by Snowden. And so I will link to the takedown of this smear campaign by Glenn Greenwald, and you can read it for yourself. Now to the underlying hack attack here in the United States. Of course, the corporate media plays the U.S. simply as victims of hackers from overseas. They take the leaked information from the Obama administration, pointing fingers at the Chinese. And I can tell you right here, right now, I don't know who's responsible for these attacks. But I am wary when our government decides, without offering any evidence or proof, that it can blame, in this case, China, when we know that IP addresses can be obscured and there are detailed systems for essentially hiding your identity online. And do our spooks have superior capabilities compared to the spooks who have hacked into the Office of Personnel Management's computers? We're originally told they got about 4 million files or files on 4 million employees. That number is now estimated to be a multiple of that, 14 million or higher. And the second system that we now know was hacked contained files related to intelligence officials working for the FBI, defense contractors, and other government agencies. That systems containing information related to background investigations of current, former, and prospective federal employees were compromised. Now, this is kind of interesting to a guy like me because you know that to 86 something in bureaucratic terms is to dispose of it, to trash it, to get rid of it. Well, there is a standard form 86, a 127-page questionnaire that you have to fill out for a security clearance with the federal government. And it is the Form 86s that didn't get 86 that are on this server that appear to have been grabbed. And it's not clear what the hackers will do with this information. Maybe compare it to other databases that they have and see who might be vulnerable to being approached as a spy. But the embarrassment of the federal government and the Obama administration is severe. And in portraying the U.S. always as a victim of cyber warfare and cyber attacks, we readily overlook our own aggressive cyber warfare operations. And who knows if this is retaliation for something that we've done that we don't know about. There are a lot of covert operations inside the, 16 to 18 intelligence agencies that are arrayed under the Director of National Intelligence. Now, for what it's worth, the New York Times says security experts say forensic evidence from the attacks suggests that they were the work of a sophisticated Chinese group that for the past 3 years has targeted a number of government agencies and defense contractors. Well, suggestion is not the same as proof. So the Obama administration, we're told, is weighing the use of an executive order to impose sanctions on individuals or groups that we believe engaged in cyber attacks. Are we going to do that based on a suggestion of the forensic evidence? The Times continues, more recently, the group appears to have been looking for inroads into the personal lives of government workers, military and intelligence personnel, and defense contractors, and it's been gathering the personal data and medical histories of its targets. While the group is not a unit of the People's Liberation Army's Third Department, which oversees the Chinese military's cyber intelligence gathering, the chronology of its attacks matches Beijing's stated economic and strategic objectives. Now, that is meaningless. There is no proof to say that it is consistent with or it suggests. And so we are left to say, gosh, we don't know. And in a case like this, my first reaction would be to want to trust my government. But I know better than that. Little good news, the gates at Gitmo opened briefly over the weekend and 6 men departed, bringing the population there down to about 116. All 6 are Yemenis. They've been cleared since 2012 for release. Most have been held since early 2002. 13 years without charge or trial. And the Gulf state nation of Oman has accepted 4. I'm sorry, they've accepted 6, and they had accepted 4 back in January. Now, I'm trying to read between the lines here because I'd like to see a lot more releases, including Shakir Amer, the last British individual held at Guantanamo. But according to the New York Times article, there are no others who are awaiting release after Congress has been notified. We're told there are 2 so-called low-level detainees, including a man from Mauritania, awaiting approval of Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, and after that, Congress would be notified. So from this information, we can only guess that 2 more may be released in the next month or so. But those descriptions don't seem to apply to Shakir Amer. In a victory for the rule of law and a specific Guantanamo inmate whose name is Ali al-Bahloul, an appeals court has thrown out his conviction based on conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism. In a 2-to-1 ruling, they said the government could prosecute him only in a civilian court if it wants to bring a conspiracy charge, because under international law, there is no such thing as conspiracy, not for war crimes. There's also no such thing as material support. Both of these are widely used in our domestic criminal court system. And this ruling has interesting implications. Now, defendants in a military commission have fewer protections. Prosecutors can use hearsay evidence, including, we think, evidence derived from torture. But those lower standards of evidence may permit trials that produce sentences for terrorism suspects who cannot be prosecuted in civilian court because the evidence against them would not be admissible. So we shop for venues where we can try to win a conviction against these guys, whether it's really legitimate and consistent with our practices or not. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. We picked up a new annual subscriber over the weekend. Last name is Adendra. Stony is the first name I pick up from the email. So Stony Adendro, thank you very much for supporting the Peter B. Collins Podcast. I'll note that another annual subscriber decided to cancel over the weekend, and I'm sorry to see that. Joey Perillo, he's a supporter of the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and Marianne Razzo does double duty. She gives $10 a month. If you'd like to join in, I'd love to hear from you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link on the homepage right under my picture. It takes you to our sign-up page. There you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers like Stony get a bonus gift from me, an ebook copy of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Well, I've become a regular and pretty loyal viewer of John Oliver's Sunday night show on HBO, Last Week Tonight, I think it's called. And he did it again last night. A comedian who's a naturalized American, but he was born in Britain, takes America to task for our torture regimes. And in John Oliver's style, he made his rant, his sermon about America's barbaric practices, humorous. And he enlisted the award-winning actress Dame Helen Mirren and got her to read passages from the Senate Torture Review or report that was published last December. And in particular, Helen Mirren gives voice to the recipe of the food that was pureed and then shoved up the ass of five different prisoners. It was called rectal feeding. But we know that humans derive no nutrition from food that is shoved up your butt. This is torture, and it is sexual torture. It is technically rape. And in a powerful op-ed published at Al Jazeera today, Antonio Giannata from Human Rights Watch makes a critical point that the CIA sexually assaulted detainees in many ways, some of which were revealed by this report, and that federal law defines rape as including penetration by any object with an intent to abuse, humiliate, harass, degrade, or arouse, or through the use of force by threatening the person with grievous bodily harm. And under this definition, the mere threat of rape is a form of sexual assault. The Senate report on CIA torture notes that the rectal feeding procedure was done without evidence of medical necessity, which is a polite way of saying that it was about torture and humiliation. And what's ironic is that George W. Bush in 2003 signed the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It defines prison rape as the rape of an inmate under the control of prison officials in any confinement facility run by the federal government. And there is no statute of limitations on crimes of rape. And so Mr. Giannata argues that the torturers who are not being prosecuted by the U.S. government under our existing torture laws, and, he didn't note, but there is an effort in the Senate to pass a, I think, meaningless law banning torture that has no penalties included whatsoever. And so this is an option. And the rape charges, I believe, could be filed by any federal prosecutor. We'll see if that happens. Meanwhile, the Vatican is getting very serious about the sex crimes in the Catholic Church, and I, for one, am glad to see it. Last week, Pope Francis announced a new tribunal system aimed at bishops and higher-ranking church officials who have either participated in sexual crimes or covered up the crimes of priests under their jurisdiction. And today they announced that the first individual charged will face a tribunal starting in July. He is the former Archbishop of the Dominican Republic, and his name is Joseph Wesolowski. Now, there was a controversy a couple of years ago because the Vatican secretly recalled him from the Dominican Republic before the officials there could investigate. But to its credit, the Vatican defrocked this archbishop last year, June a year ago. That would have been on Francis's watch. And he will be the first one tried under this new system. So at least the appearance of accountability is now present, and I am very glad to see it. On these shores, today, the Archbishop and Deputy Bishop in Minneapolis and St. Paul both resigned after prosecutors recently charged them with failing to protect youth from abuse by pedophile priests. And the Archbishop who just resigned, John Nienstedt, also has faced accusations personally. One that he grabbed the butt of an altar boy or a teenager at a ceremony, a confirmation ceremony. He did step aside while that was investigated and there was no prosecution. But in another case, the Archdiocese announced that it received claims regarding alleged misbehavior against the Archbishop, said to be about a series of sexual relationships with men, including seminarians and priests. Well, I'm glad to see that the Vatican did not interfere with the secular prosecution of the Archbishop and his deputy. And we'll see if they also get tried in the Vatican tribunal as well. The Supreme Court today refused to hear an appeal from North Carolina seeking to maintain a state law that requires doctors to perform ultrasounds before allowing a woman to receive an abortion. Now, while this is good news for North Carolina, the Supreme Court sidestepped the opportunity to rule on this from the bench and set a national precedent. And that shows how wobbly the Supreme Court is on abortion rights today. Because we have other federal appeals courts who've upheld the ultrasound laws from Texas and South Dakota. And that's why the Supreme Court is supposed to resolve the difference between these circuits, the circuit courts of appeal. And as a result, today's ruling sets no precedent. It only affects North Carolina. And I think that's very sad. In an in-depth interview discussion today, I talked with Aspen Baker. She's a very interesting woman, very bright. She talks openly about an abortion she had a few years ago. And she's written a book called Pro-Voice. She says, I'm not pro-choice, I'm not pro-life, I am pro-voice. And you will hear in the interview, she makes a compelling case that there is a third way to discuss abortion, and it involves the experiences of women who've actually had abortions, without judging them, without trying to push them into a camp of pro or anti. And I'm fascinated by her approach, and I validate it in most respects. But when you listen to the interview, you'll hear me put up a little fight toward the end, because I believe that the fundamental right of a woman to choose an abortion is under serious assault in this country. And I believe that Aspen Baker is ducking that fight. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with new author Aspen Baker about pro-voice. And so I don't have confidence that the fundamental right of an abortion across the 50 states will remain in place. And as you have this other conversation, which is as I say, you know, valuable and valid in every way I can think of, my concern is that the access will be restricted, and we even could see abortion once again outlawed, at least at the state level, if not at the federal level in this country.
There is, frankly and honestly, nothing I can say that's going to say, don't worry about that. I can't calm your concern. I can't calm your fear about that. what I know is that the pro-voice mission and pro-voice leadership helps people talk to each other. And it helps them talk to each other even when they disagree about things. And it helps them take courageous risks that they might not otherwise, because there's room for their story to be heard. When there's only political fighting, it shuts down many of those stories and many of those voices. Right, so there's tension in both of those things.
But amid the conversations mm-hmm. that you're talking about, are there good faith compromises made by people of principle who come together through your pro-voice frame, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
And can they arrive at some sort of a compromise where people who consider abortion to be a sin and a crime can accept that, you know, we need to mitigate the harm from illegal abortion, as we saw in the past? And can you find so-called pro-choice people who are willing to accept some restrictions as long as they are not a path toward total abolition of abortion rights?
So the question that I'm hearing is, can pro-voice conversations save the political fight by figuring out the perfect public policy?
Okay.
Probably not. And probably not right now.
You can hear the full interview with Aspen Baker. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. Also on the abortion topic, The Guardian has done a recap of the candidates for president, radical right-wing Republicans, who are all supporting Lindsey Graham's bill, which reduces the window when abortion is legal from 26 weeks to 20 weeks. His co-sponsors include all the other guys in the Senate who are running for president: Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz. And not to be left out, Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, who fancies himself as the next president, is expected to sign a 20-week abortion ban in Wisconsin in the next few weeks. And this one is extreme. It contains no exceptions for rape or incest, the life of the mother. Very extreme stuff. And this is why I raised the issue with Aspen Baker, because her approach of, you know, giving women a forum to talk about their abortions is just fine. But by avoiding taking a position on these efforts to roll back access to abortion and ultimately make it illegal, I think is really frightening. And the political failure here is astounding. Hillary Clinton, in her fighting speech in New York on Saturday, she told thousands of supporters that Republicans shame and blame women rather than respect our right to make our own reproductive health decisions. Now, that's a nice statement. But you note she didn't use the word abortion. No, her pollsters have told her that the A word can cost her votes. And so, one of the things that Aspen Baker advances is the idea that abortion is a complicated subject and that there are many gray areas, people who hold conflicting views in the same person. It's true. But we can't allow these gray areas to permit the opponents of abortion rights to move to squelch access to abortion and ultimately try to ban it. And that's what I fear will happen, as many people are distracted or stand idly by. So speaking of Hillary Clinton, she gave a speech in Iowa on Sunday where she talked about the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but she failed to take a clear position. She's dancing around it, saying that she thinks President Obama should listen to Congress and Nancy Pelosi and negotiate a better deal for America's workers. And Bernie Sanders correctly noted that she has not clearly taken a position on this bad treaty. So the TPP ain't dead yet. There are going to be a couple of rounds of votes this week in the House, and it doesn't appear they can close the gap. And Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, on Friday, I think, stunned the president by her floor speech where she said she wasn't ready to give fast track on this package. But lots of maneuvers can take place. Votes in the House can be bought. And there is a lot of pressure being brought to bear to produce that outcome. So don't let up if you've been calling Capitol Hill. Keep those calls moving, will you? Finally today, I want to commend Bill Curry, who writes at Salon.com, because he took a look at some recent polls and said, you know, Bernie Sanders could win. And I think it's really important because we see the corporate media routinely simply dismiss Bernie Sanders as a fringe candidate. And they bet on the consensus that Hillary Clinton can easily win the nomination and never really mention that she could win the nomination and lose the election. And so this guy, Bill Curry, notes that corruption is an issue that galvanizes voters all around the world. We live amidst a global pandemic of corruption. It ravages Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, devours Africa. It was the issue at the heart of every uprising in the Arab Spring. It has spurred riots in India and Brazil, struck fear in the hearts of China's leaders, contributed mightily to the warping of Russia's politics. It tops liberal agendas everywhere in the world, everywhere but here. Then he notes that major retailers across the country itemize the corruption in their sector. It's called inventory shrinkage. In 2013, retailers across the U.S. pegged their shrinkage at $37 billion. But there's no public sector budget that itemizes the cost of corruption in our government. Then he notes a recent poll that the New York Times conducted. 85% of respondents said the system needs fundamental change or to be completely rebuilt. 85% said politicians do their donors' bidding some or all of the time. 78% want to limit spending by independent groups. 75% would require disclosure of donations to any entity engaged in politics. Only 23% said all Americans have an equal voice in their democracy. And so I think this is a very interesting path to potential victory that Bill Curry has outlined for Bernie Sanders. Think about it. And let me know what you think. You can drop me an email at any time, peter@peterbcollins.com. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment today. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone. So get going on that, will you? Put it up on Facebook. Click like. My Facebook page is Peter B. Collins Show. And I hope you'll drop by and click on that Get Notifications link so you get a Facebook post every time I post a new podcast. I'm Peter B. Thanks for joining me.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.